Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to The Critic podcast. I'm Sebastian Moorbank, executive editor, and I'm joined by a very special guest, David Scullion, a consultant, a journalist, a former staffer for Suella Braverman, but most impressively all, the one-time online editor of The Critic magazine. David, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's good to be back.
So this week, we're talking about the age-old Tory question, who governs Britain? On the agenda is, of course, the late Home Secretary, the cabinet reshuffle, the role of the special advisor in Westminster, and most interestingly of all, I think, you know, how will a future Labour government deal with an increasingly difficult civil service, Metropolitan Police Force, and a host of other increasingly unruly public servants? So on all of that, David, shall we just sort of recap for listeners what this rather turbulent last few days in Westminster have involved?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Suella has raised the ire of Number 10 over the last few months. She made a speech in the US, has said that multiculturalism has failed, and most recently wrote an article for The Times, which wasn't fully signed off by Number 10. The edits that Number 10 made to the article weren't included in the final draft. And she said that the police played favourites when they were policing protests. And ultimately, it's led to her being sacked.
Mm. Yeah, so, and of course, as listeners will probably know, we've got a Lord Cameron now as Foreign Secretary. Former Foreign Secretary James Cleverly has gone over to the Home Office. There's been a few other reshuffles, but those are the ones that are making headlines. So let's start in on this question. So, I mean, just again, as I said on top of the programme, David, you've worked for Suella as a special advisor, so you have some and so though of course you've got no direct line to what's been going on the last few weeks, you do have some insight into what this role involves and how these things happen. So what do you think has gone wrong with these edits?
I mean, it's hard to say. I think the sign-off process for articles or for speeches or anything that goes out in the name of a minister is just probably one of the worst things you can do as a special advisor and probably anyone involved. I mean, it kind of writing for a minister is where it's where kind of flair and the exciting part of writing is basically where good writing goes to die. The sign-off process is like pulling teeth. First, somebody writes the thing, and you better hope that's you. If you're a speechwriter, if you're the kind of the media person, you better hope it's you that writes the first draft, because that's what you've got to work with, and that's what you've got to try and sort out. But it's bad news if it's a policy person, because it will read like a kind of instruction manual that's been translated from Chinese, and it gets passed around to absolutely everybody who could potentially have any kind of stake in the game. So if you mention anything about education, it has to go through education. If you mention anything about health, it has to go to health, and it also has to get signed off by Number 10 as well. So it's a torturous process, and it's awful, and it goes back and forth and back and forth, and there are sometimes multiple versions going around. It's a complete mess, and by the end it's mainly just unreadable unless you really try and sort it out. So it's not an easy process. It's not a fun process at all. And it is very possible for things to go wrong. I don't know specifically what happened in this instance, but it seems like the kind of edits that Number 10 put in didn't make it to the final draft, which could easily be possible if there are multiple versions going around and nobody knows which one is the current up-to-date one. So yeah, it seems like a bit of a cock-up rather than conspiracy.
Yeah, see, I mean, with this recent resignation, I mean, do you think it would normally be the case that miscommunication about a document coming out would be a cause for a minister to resign, or do you think this is a case of the straw that broke the camel's back?
I mean, like, civil servants take this really, really seriously. The idea of speaking with one voice and not kind of treading on anyone's toes in terms of policy and making sure that everybody's happy for it to be signed off. I mean, they're kind of over the top concerned in my view, but I think no, I don't think it would be, but I think it's the cumulative effect of Suella saying things which the Prime Minister was not happy with and which he then distanced himself from. He wouldn't repeat a lot of the words she said when she said multiculturalism has failed. He said we live in a great multi-ethnic democracy, or whatever he said. I think it's the cumulative effect of that and her agitating and pushing to go in a direction that he was not happy with, even though I would argue it's all things that he's said he's in favour of. But when it actually comes to it, he's not really on the same page politically as her.
You say, I mean, do you think this is a question of, you know, substance or tone when it comes to the tension between the Home Secretary and the late Home Secretary and the Prime Minister? It doesn't sound like she's dead. Former Home Secretary and Prime Minister. I mean, it seems, I mean, you know, from an outside observer, you know, you're Westminster insider, I'm a very much Westminster outsider. I look at what sort of Suella and Priti Patel before her get up to and they say, and it seems obvious that Number 10 wants that kind of rhetoric out there to clearly keep people on the right happy, but they don't necessarily want to empower a Home Secretary to do too much about it and upset people. So I just feel that there's always this kind, so that I feel like often when they say you get these differing statements from Prime Minister and Home Secretary, it's sort of because the Home Secretary in British politics has sort of morphed into this sort of, you know, it's like you've got to imagine there's like the nice dad and mean mummy. There's one parent who's made to be the disciplinarian. And that's rather what the Home Secretary seems to have turned into.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way of putting it. And I think in terms of Suella, I think there's an increasing frustration with not being able to do the things that she was told that were going to be done. And so therefore the kind of the outlet for that is just rhetoric, in absence of being allowed to do these kind of things. I think that's a good way of looking at it. And I think having her there politically is very helpful for him, especially having a right-wing Home Secretary and pretty fulfilled a kind of similar function before. I think Suella's gone before people were really saying, before people had kind of started saying in earnest, look, you're not prepared to do any of this stuff. Like, you talk tough, but you're not doing anything. And there probably would have come a point where it's a case of kind of saying, well, you've been saying this for a long time. If you really are blocked from doing it, you probably need to resign. And that point hadn't come yet. She sacked before that had come. So it's quite, I mean, it's probably quite good for her politically to be sacked at this moment if she's not going to be allowed to do these things before getting kind of any serious criticism from the right of the party.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's a very good time to get fired. You know, everyone thinks, you know, there'll be a general election soon. It seems likely. It seems equally likely that the Conservatives are going to do very badly at it. It's a good time not to be in government, and being fired for being too right-wing is probably a recommendation for the average Conservative member, and probably quite a few MPs as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You put out a very funny tweet comparing the facial expressions of David Cameron entering government, looking very solemn, and Suella smiling as she left Downing Street, just a mere MP.
Oh, well, it was, you know, it's all media manipulation, David. You know, I scrolled for all the pictures of David Cameron beaming beatifically so I could select one of him looking miserable. So that's how we do it. I don't have to tell you. But no, I mean, she did look unusually cheery leaving her house on Monday morning. I think that was the photo. So I suspect she possibly feels, I mean, I'm not in a position to say, but perhaps she feels relieved not to have to be everybody's fall girl anymore for the nation's problems. And we'll have to see how Jeremy cleverly gets on. Now, before we go any further, I think we should say, what exactly is a SPAD or a special advisor? As I think a lot of people, you know, they've seen an episode of political, some satirical program, The Thick of It or something, and they think a SPAD is someone who shouts at people. What does a SPAD actually do?
But special advisors, yes, SPAD is just a contracted form of special advisor, kind of a slightly horrible sounding word, but they came in the 60s under Harold Wilson. Harold Wilson's first Labour government brought in special advisors. And for a long time, they were seen as quite a weird thing. They're basically a temporary civil servant, so you can lose your job at any moment. SPADs at the moment are... the employment of SPADs is all tied to the Prime Minister. So the Prime Minister has to sign off on every single SPAD appointment and can sack any SPAD. So SPADs are supposed to work for the whole government, but often you are just working for your minister. And I don't think there's that whole government approach works quite as well as is intended. But the idea of being kind of appointed by the Prime Minister, it's not just a formality. I mean, when Michael Gove was Education Secretary, he had a SPAD. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's called Dominic Cummings. And David Cameron was so annoyed by some of his briefing that he sacked him from education. So that is a real, it's a real thing that it's the Prime Minister who picks them. I think there's a scene in Yes Minister where Jim Hacker is he's had a political advisor with a northern accent called Frank Wise or Weasel or something. And when Jim Hacker gets his first ministerial job, this political advisor comes into the office expecting to be given a plum job and still working for him. And the permanent secretary, Sir Humphrey Appleby, just shuts the door in his face. And that's basically what civil servants want to do to SPADs all the time. There's a kind of, I like to say love-hate, but it's more of a hate-hate relationship between proper civil servants and special advisors who are temporary civil servants who can be party political.
So on that relationship with the civil service, I mean, it has that, do you think that's a recent antagonism? Is it built into the system? Has it got worse recently over time?
Well, they didn't used to exist. SPADs didn't used to exist.
I'm more just being like the relationship between kind of political politicians and ministers, people who work for them, and civil servants.
Yeah, I think it definitely doesn't seem like it's in a good place at the moment. I think SPADs are definitely essential at the moment. I think they're essential and a really good part of government, but definitely essential at the moment where the trust is so low between ministers and civil servants. SPADs, you can by and large trust SPADs that they don't want you to lose your job as a minister, but that's not true of almost anyone else in the civil service. It's civil service. Yeah, the relationship is not good between the civil servants and conservative ministers. For a large part, because they're not conservative in their politics at all. But in another sense, which will have a bearing on Labour, is that they work for their own interests and they don't care who their minister is. They are a bureaucracy and they're a self-fulfilling bureaucracy and they do what's best for the bureaucracy. So there's definitely a political divide, but I think to a lesser extent, Labour will find it difficult if and when they form the next government.
I think a lot of people might be under the impression that when a government's elected and, you know, ministers and the prime minister come into power, that they come in and they can tell the civil service to do something and it's their job to do it. Now, I suppose it's not always so simple. So, for example, let's be more specific. Let's say you want, you're an incoming education secretary and you want to do something in education and you feel that a certain civil servant, that's a senior civil servant, isn't doing the job properly, they're not doing it on a timetable, you're not happy with how they're doing it. Can a minister simply fire the civil servant and hire someone who they think would do a better job?
No, they can't.
That's where I suspect some of the disconnect between the general public's view of what politicians are supposed to be doing and civil servants' view might start emerging.
I mean, politics is essentially a court. No, you can't. There's no hiring and firing capabilities. I mean, you can, like a court, you can kind of exile people by just not including them and things. And it's not a kind of, it's not a good way to do things at all. And I know the civil servants will say, oh, well, you know, we need job security and we need to think that we can give advice without fear or favour to our ministers. But like practically, it makes no sense. If the minister is supposed to be your boss and you're supposed to do everything for the minister and you're supposed to serve the elected government, the fact that you can't be sacked if you've done something wrong, or you just can't be sacked at all, you can kind of be potentially exiled to kind of political Siberia and go to the government art collection or something. But basically, no, you can't. And it's a real problem. The job security of ministers and spads is far more tenuous than that of established civil servants, which is part of the big problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, another question. So to come back to some of the content of the controversy of the last few days, Suella Braverman made a very specific contention that the Metropolitan Police had been politicised. Now, we'll get on to whether that's true or not, but on the kind of procedural point that's come up of the Met have operational independence and the Home Secretary isn't empowered to tell them how to police, say, a protest, how much is that true? How much has that always been true?
I'm not kind of my area of expertise. I've not been in the Home Office, but it's certainly a good tactic to say that you can't do anything about it. I mean, it's certainly a good tactic for the Met to say we have operational independence. I mean, practically they will be meeting the head of the Met a lot, and there's definitely an informal pressure that you can bring on kind of things that are supposedly independent, like the Met and quangos and things. But I think the idea of independence and the kind of kind of quangos and of things like the Met, it's almost kind of exalted to a kind of mythical constitutional status that I really think just shouldn't be the case. You know, obviously you don't want the Home Secretary personally directing Metropolitan Police officers to kind of search the Labour Party offices or anything like that, but
what are they hiding, David? Like, how are we supposed to know?
But yeah, I mean, it's just like the hollowing out of the state, the idea that all these quangos are completely independent and that's some kind of by divine writ. It just makes the whole thing ungovernable, and they use it as a weapon all the time. You try anything, trying to get anything done in independent quangos or independent bodies, which the minister in departments always get blamed for when things go wrong. The Attorney General's office has the serious fraud office, the CPS, and the government legal department. Anything that goes wrong, it came down to the Attorney General, and that's the same for every department. Anything that goes wrong in any of the kind of quangos or independent bodies, they all get blamed, but they can't take any credit when anything goes right. And it's a false economy. I guess if these things are being run really well and efficiently, then that's fine. But that's, I don't think anyone really agrees that that's the case, or really anything in Britain's running well at the moment. When Tony Blair became Prime Minister, I think Jonathan Powell, his Chief of Staff, said that they found that when they got there, it was kind of hard to find any levers of power because the power of the state was so widely dissipated amongst all the institutions. And I think that's probably a lot worse now, and especially when you're working with a civil service that knows that the Conservatives' time is probably up compared to Blair when he's at the cusp of his power in 97. It is just a big problem that it's very hard to find any levers that really do anything.
But, like, you know, for example, what's stopping? I mean, obviously, I'm possibly unfairly asking you this question, but, you know, the Conservatives have been in power for 13 years. For most of that time, they've had a functional parliamentary majority. Sometimes they've had quite a big parliamentary majority. Are you telling me they couldn't have got a majority of Tory MPs, a necessary parliamentary majority, to vote a bill saying we can hire and fire civil servants, or empowering them to do what they need to do? I mean, you know, the power of Parliament in our constitution is pretty total. If they aren't able to do something, can't they just empower themselves to do it?
That's a completely legitimate criticism, absolutely. And that's absolutely what they should have done, and they should have done it early on, and they should have been making these big reforms that made it possible to govern from the start. I think there'd be a lot of Tory MPs who would not be in favour of that. A lot of Tory MPs are kind of quite Blairite in their politics anyway. It's quite hard to find many MPs who are exercised by the idea of governmental reform. And that's a completely valid and legitimate criticism. But I think probably someone arguing from the other side would possibly say, well, look, we had so many problems. We were dealing with the aftermath of the credit crunch when Cameron became prime minister. We've had Brexit. We've had a lot of things. I don't agree. I mean, that's probably what they'd say. I think, no, these are actually really, really fundamental things. And these are like how you actually do anything and how you govern at all. And so I think that's a completely legitimate criticism. I would agree with you on that. But when you're in the position you're in now, it probably is too late to, with a year or so left.
Yeah.
It probably actually is too late to try to kind of tackle any of those big things. But definitely something that should have been done early on. But maybe, I guess, partly the thinking now could be, well, Labour about to get in. I don't want to make it easier for them.
Yeah, and on that, actually, I mean, Labour have been very hot on, you know, civil service bullying stories on them, institutional independence of the Met. They've, you know, and obviously if you're the opposition, it makes sense for you to take whatever the opposite side of the government is on something that hurts them. But is there a sense in which they're setting themselves up to fail? Because they're not far from power now. And they're going to need civil servants to do what they want them to do. They're going to be in battles potentially with, you know, the public sector unions, with civil servants, with all these people when they want to get things done. I mean, do you think it's just that they're counting on the political sympathies of civil servants to be with them? Is it they genuinely believe in the independence of the civil servant and have a kind of establishment attitude towards it? I mean, what's going on there?
No, I think it's quite a cynical thing. I don't really think they are that excited by the idea of the independence of the civil service or the Met or anything like that. I think as soon as they got into power, I think you're right. I think they'll fight those same battles. I think it's just a cynical kind of party political thing that they're saying. And I think, yeah, it will. The Tories will probably try and clip up things that they've said and fire back at them. But I don't think it will have a huge amount of effect when they're in their first term of office.
And on the, you know, on this question of the Met specifically, I mean, do you think we've seen the events of this weekend. There was a very large march, pro-Palestine march. There were fireworks thrown. There were far-right protesters turning up at the cenotaph. I mean, do you think that this suggestion that the Met hasn't been policing in a fair and systematic way holds up?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I do. And I think when you see... I think, in some sense, understandably, because it's easier to arrest people who aren't going to fight back. I mean, it's easier to arrest the person silently praying outside an abortion clinic than it is to kind of really try and tackle a huge Palestinian protest and people waving placards, anti-Semitic placards, or whatever. I think. But yeah, I definitely think there's that. And I definitely think that it definitely seems like there is a fear of being racist, and there's a fear of favouring one community over the other. And it filters down to everything. Everyone's so careful when they're discussing the protests at Armistice Day. Everyone, the police and the Labour Party, everyone, everyone is almost, I think, could breathe a sigh of relief when they found out that the EDL and the far right were protesting at the same time, because they could put that one first. They could say, look at these evil white hooligans who were trashing things, and also a few wayward peaceful Palestinian protesters as well. So they could, I think it was great news for them politically that the EDL were there as well. Because there is a huge worry about criticizing alone, criticizing certain communities in Britain that are pro-Palestine.
Yeah, and I mean, I was also thinking, the way that, for example, protest on the during the coronation was handled, the police just stomped on it. Like, anyone who was anywhere near it got, like, bundled into a van. They arrested people preemptively. They moved around the crowds. They completely locked everything down. And it's so striking that the Met can be very aggressive when it wants to be, if it feels it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I think you're right. There was that amazing story, wasn't there? That Australian that got that pro-monarchist, was it Australian or something that got bundled up as well because she was near some Republic protesters. So there was the kind of the mere whiff that she might be an anti-monarchist. I think that's a really good point. That's a really good analogy to bring, that they can do it when they want to. Because I think I've heard people saying of the Met and possibly ex-Met police officers, you know, what can we do? We can't do anything about it. You know, we've got to allow the right to protest. And we've got to uphold, cherish British freedoms. But you're right. When they want to do it, they can do it.
And I get the sense that there's also this desire not to do the kind of policing that would stop a protest like that. And, you know, in someone, you know, what do they do in France when there are 100,000 people on the streets? There often are, and they're likely to be violent if they try and stop it. They get the water cannon out, they get the tear gas out, they put their riot shields up and they charge in. And I kind of quite understand why people don't want scenes like that in Britain, but is there a degree to which police are doing things they probably shouldn't be doing to try to avoid that? In terms of, like, confronting people, perhaps they should be confronted.
Yes, I think you're right. I think you'd probably write a book about the history of the water cannon in Britain. That's I think it's just used in Northern Ireland at the moment. And then Boris Johnson bought one as mayor of London, and then Theresa May made a big thing about selling it off because it was somehow un-British to use water cannons. Yeah, I think definitely, and definitely there's that's the case.
So away from the Met and the streets of London, and back to the streets of the city of Westminster, what's it like, if I could ask such a sort of direct question, like being in Westminster? What's the culture? What does it feel like to be a kind of member of that tribe, even briefly?
I think when things are happening, when there's exciting things happening, it's incredibly exhilarating. I think definitely as a SPAD coming in, you've got real power, and that's very exciting. And you've got someone who sorts your diary out for you, and you can really wield power. There's definitely a sense of a court though. I think that's the thing you don't really realize, which is that it's power is often the perception of power. So if you are perceived to have the ear of the minister, you're not kind of out of favor. I know there are some cabinet ministers who had many, many spads, and some of them were in favor at times and some of them were out of favor. And the ones that were out of favour and very clearly out of favour would get almost nothing done because everybody knows they don't have the ear of the minister. But I think it's the perception that you have the ear of the minister, and for ministers as well. I mean, I spoke to one former cabinet minister in the last Labour government, who was saying that it works the exact same thing for ministers. For ministers, it's if you are perceived to be in line with the prime minister's view, then civil servants will do exactly what you say. And so definitely court politics is at play. But I mean, on the other side, it's also a bit like an episode of W1A, and there's management speak, and there's civil servant management speak on top of management speak. It becomes ridiculous, and kind of the impossibility to get anything done. I mean, there are probably, I think, I don't know how many words there are for snow for Eskimos, but there are probably about 1,000 words for no in the civil service lexicon. So I think just deeply, deeply frustrating. Doing anything that you think is simple would kind of be simple outside of government suddenly becomes impossible. And sometimes this is understandable. So, for example, I was trying to get Suella's media appearances clipped up into little short videos to just be stuck out on social media. And no, that's just impossible, because you can't clip a bit of Sky News, because that's Sky's copyright. And whilst you can do, whilst every single think tank outside of outside of government is doing that in Westminster, and there's a kind of tacit agreement, and the Sky don't really mind because it's kind of promotion for them. But yeah, technically it is a breach of copyright. The government can't do that because the government can't break the law. So there are some senses in which that's understandable. But I guess there's a broader point, which is they've never really tried. They've never really approached any of the broadcasters. They don't really want to get any of this stuff done. And I think the kind of the less intelligent civil servants might just say no to you directly. But then the slightly cleverer civil servants would say, oh, we'll look into this, or we'll do a fact-finding mission to Peru before we can get you an answer. And I think the sheer inertia of the civil service and sometimes just outright hostility is quite breathtaking. And you almost, it's almost just being gaslit every day that something you think is just really simple, you're getting told, oh, that's incredibly brave. Or, I mean, there is a lot of the lines from Yes Minister that you think, oh, that is actually what they say. Like, it's incredibly brave, or we've never done that before, or like, maybe it kind of hints that what you're trying to achieve is unconstitutional. And you have to kind of take a moment and you have to talk to people outside of government and say, hang on a minute, this isn't a controversial or difficult thing to do, is it? And everyone outside government says, no, like, what, that's ridiculous. Like, you can't even get that done. You know, what hope is there to achieve any kind of major reform or any big policy direction?
So it's sort of half medieval court, half Kafka.
Yeah, I think that's, exactly, yes. If I write a book, that will be my subheading.
Okay, I mean, I remember, I think somebody once described the Gulf's monarchies as 10th century feudal states with modern technology. And my question is not maybe 100% far off from that. So looking away from our main subject of who governs Britain, I wanted to ask you about some of these recent reshuffles. So obviously we've now got a Lord back in the cabinet. Now, I think the last one was David Frost, I think briefly a Lord in the cabinet. And then before it was Peter Mandelson. And that's one of the two most recent examples I can think of.
Well, we've always had the leader of the House of Lords is always in cabinet.
Yeah.
So at the moment, that's Lord True. But you're right. Yeah. And we've had Lord Frost, Boris Johnson's Brexit negotiator, who was actually, he actually wrote an article saying that he wasn't really a fan of the foreign secretary being in the Lords because he lacked scrutiny. But somehow it was fine for him to be in the Lords when he was Brexit secretary. But who knows?
It's been a while since we've had one of the great offices of state occupied by a Lord.
Yes, I suppose that is his point. Yes, you're right. But yeah, there have been Lords in the cabinet. I mean, Gordon Brown appointed Lord Sugar, he made him appear, and he attended cabinet as well. But yes, in terms of the great offices of state, it is a bit of a change. Nicky Morgan was culture secretary, not one of the great offices, but she was culture secretary in the Lords for a while after she was sacked for her Brexit betrayal, but then suddenly made a peer. But I mean, if you think if you're thinking back, way back, William Pitt the Younger was I think one of his terms of office, he was the only member of the cabinet who was actually in the House of Commons. So as Prime Minister, he was defending all government policy, and all of the rest of his cabinet ministers were in the Lords. So it's not a constitutional aberration, but yeah, it is a bit of an unusual one.
There's a sort of thing going around about, you know, how will he be scrutinized? Is that something that worries you? Because obviously, you know, just to make it clear to listeners, if you are an MP in the Commons and you're a cabinet minister, you stand up and you have to answer questions to your fellow MPs. But if you're a Lord and a cabinet minister, you can only be questioned by your fellow peers and obviously a non-elected chamber.
Yeah, exactly. But cabinet ministers who are MPs will be scrutinised by MPs, but they also have deputies in the Lords. So there'll often be a deputy, often be a junior foreign Foreign Office Minister will be a Lord, and so they'll be doing the same thing. So it will just be mirrored. So Lord Cameron now will stand up and answer questions in the Lords, but he'll have junior foreign ministers, any urgent questions or any statements to be made, he'll just have a deputy that will deputise for him in the House of Commons. So I don't really see it as that much of a kind of problem of scrutiny.
Yeah. And I mean, do you, from a political perspective, I mean, what do you think Rishi Sunak's trying to achieve by bringing Cameron back into politics? Do you think it will help him?
I don't know. I mean, it's a slightly strange thing in that we've had the Conservative conference where it was the kind of setup for the next general election, and this is my team and this is our direction. And now we've definitely taken a kind of, it's become a lot more leftwards and possibly a leftward kind of tilt before the general election. And I know that there's some kind of One Nation people saying, oh, the adults are back in the room, which I think is always a convenient to brand your own side the adults, and we're, you know, just the pragmatists, that it's all our ideological opponents are just crazed ideologues who are deeply tribal. I think there's definitely it's definitely a kind of he's remade the cabinet potentially just in his own image, which kind of mirrors the kind of John Major reshuffle before his huge defeat. I don't think it will work. I don't really think by kind of getting closer to Keir Starmer, you can really out Starmer. And I think the perception of David Cameron, I think some opinion polling recently, doesn't seem like people think daddy's home. That's the...
He's home, my God. Yes, I mean, you say it's a shift to the left. Do you think there's a sense in which, you know, with obviously, you know, up before this reshuffle, it was a more right-wing, you know, face that they were showing to the country. Do you think there's a sense they were trying to sort of recapture the 2019 Boris Johnson coalition, and that perhaps they're no longer trying to do so? Maybe trying to go back to Cameron, going back to kind of Cameron's coalition?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And that's definitely one that's been made. It's the kind of let's target people that flip between the Lib Dems and the Conservatives and the kind of home counties, rather than tackle all the kind of people who voted for UKIP in Lincolnshire. And let's just hold on to the base rather than try and keep that coalition together. I think that's a fair assessment. I just think it's very unambitious, and it's I think they'll still be defeated anyway, probably. And it does kind of chime. I mean, you might say Liz Truss really messed up, and of course she did really mess up, but it does kind of chime with Liz Truss's criticism of Rishi, which is this is managed decline. Like, let's just shore up the base and batten down the hatches and kind of go into hibernation, and at least we got Richmond and kept our Surrey seats. It's not really an inspiring vision and an inspiring leader of the Conservative Party that kind of goes for that approach.
So, you know, if, as you know, as you said, you know, it seems likely they're not going to have any success in the next election. Obviously, there'll have to be a new Conservative leader. Who do you think that might be? And do you think that Suella is going to be throwing a hat into the ring in a year or two's time?
I mean, she hasn't told me she's going to be throwing her hat into the ring, but I think it's likely that she would. I think she's still very ambitious, and I think she is the person on the right to beat at the moment. In a way that she wasn't. There were a lot of contenders in the last leadership election that she stood in that I was part of. There were a lot of contenders on the right, and the ERG, the European Research Group of backbench pro-Brexit MPs, split between Liz Truss and Suella. And obviously, Liz Truss is gone now. There's also Kemi on the right, normally on the right. I wouldn't really say she's on the right, but she's still in government, so she's still tied to the kind of now Cameroon-tinged cabinet that Rishi's built around himself. I think Suella would be the one to beat on the right. And I think if we are kind of flitting between left and right leaders, perceived left and right leaders, then I think it probably would swing back to Suella. But, you know, anything can happen in a leadership election, and frequently crazy things do happen. So, yeah.
You don't think we're going to see any people sort of appear from, you know, the mists of Tory history to try back onto the stage like David Cameron? You think we could see a George Osborne return? Are they all going to come riding back into town?
Well, yeah, but I'm potentially, you know, with them, potentially if Barack Obama's the Democratic nominee, then potentially we will see, you know, see a return of the adults to the room.
The adults are back. Right. Well, I think with that, I'll say thank you very much to David Scullion for all of these slightly despair laced insights.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, David.
Bye.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.